to this Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Episode number 50. Welcome to episode 50. Well, I've been looking forward to this episode for some time, as with this, we've hit the 50 episode mark. That's 50 weeks of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. I want to thank you all that keep on listening for doing just that. One of the things that I constantly hear from listeners is that you appreciate the tips and you get useful snippets that you can put into your own photography via my experiences in photography that I relay to you with this podcast. And you often tell me that these are applicable to your own photography, which is really, really one of the things that makes it so worthwhile me doing this. From today, for a few weeks, I'm going to take a brief look at each episode to date and give you a mention of what was discussed and mention one or two of the main points from that podcast. I won't be able to cover all the tips, of course. There's so much that I've put into each of the podcasts that just wouldn't be possible or realistic. You might as well just go back and listen to them all. But kind of to celebrate the achievement of reaching the 50th episode as well, I'm hoping that this will also be a way to not only condense the main gist of what I've covered so far, but also give newcomers a brief outline of what's in the archives. There are going to be many more pearls hiding in the old episodes, but with so much listening time needed to catch up, it's hard to think of where to start. Hopefully this will give you some pointers though, so if you do think something is maybe interesting to listen a little bit more about, then maybe you can note down the episode number I'll give you at the beginning of each, when I start talking about each one, and go back and listen to the archive at a later date. As I go through them, I'll also talk about things that have changed since I first spoke about the topic in the original podcast, any of the tips and techniques as necessary. So it'll be kind of like a condensed update too. I'll be as brief as possible, but I'm still going to need 2 or maybe 3 weeks after this to cover everything to date, along with the updates. So please bear with me, hopefully it will be worthwhile. Before we do go on to the main topic for today though, although I usually leave housekeeping to the end of the show, today I want to share some great news with all of you about one of our long-time members. Normally I check my email before I start to record an episode, but last week I was a little pushed for time and I decided to go ahead and just record it first. I really regretted this, as it meant that I had to wait a whole week to tell you this news, as Graham Morgan, the username n.s.w, I guess for New South Wales in Australia, he'd mailed me on the Monday last week, and I didn't pick his mail up until after I recorded the show. Well, like I say, I really regretted it because I wanted to bring you this news last week if possible. But basically, Graham, I'm really pleased to tell you this is something that is just, I'm just thrilled about, probably nowhere near as much as even Graham himself is. But Graham has won 2 prizes in the Australian Wildlife Photography Competition. In fact, he's not only won prizes, his image Gannets at Barrera won the first place in the interpretive section, and his image Entrance at Sunrise took 2nd place in the landscape section. I did start a post straight away after receiving the email from Graham, and congratulations have been flooding in, but I just wanted to say a huge congratulations, this is capital letters, to Graham in the podcast itself. Graham often tells me how happy he is to be part of the MBP family, but I can tell you, Graham, that you've definitely done us proud. I hear that the competition is open to professionals and amateurs from Australia and New Zealand and gets a wide publicity, as it's their most prestigious wildlife photography competition. The winning images will be published nationally in the weekend press, or have been published nationally in the weekend press on the 17th of September, and Graham's images, along with the other shortlisted entries, will become part of an exhibition that tours the country and will be published in a book. I know that Graham is thrilled to bits on his wins, and I'm so happy for you too, as I know the other listeners are. Once again, congratulations, Graham, and it's a well-deserved win for your amazing images. And with that, let's get on to today's main topic. Okay, so let's get started on a few, maybe one or two tips from each of the last 49 episodes. I'm going to go through these in chronological order, starting with the oldest first, and not in order of importance or usefulness, as it will really depend on the individual, what is more useful or important to each person, basically. I'll include some, but not all, images from the previous episodes too, as that wouldn't be realistic either. But if you want to see all the examples from each of them, and you haven't listened to the original episode, you know, as I said in the introduction, you know, maybe you can go back and listen to the archives, depending on the podcast that you think you might be more interested in, based on the brief explanation of that I'll give through this week and the next few weeks. So on to the first tip. Way back in episode 1, I touched on a rule of thumb that you can use to avoid camera shake, and I referred to image number 595. Basically, if you use a shutter speed the same or faster than your lens's focal length, you should be able to handhold your camera without introducing camera shake. For example, if you're shooting at 100mm, you should use a shutter speed of 1/100th of a second or faster. If you are shooting with a digital SLR that does not have a full-size sensor, you'll also need to increase the shutter speed due to the crop factor, which might be 1.3, 1.5 or 1.6, depending on your camera. So if, say, you're using a Canon EOS 30D or 20D, etc., you'd have to multiply the focal length of 100 by 1.6 to get 160. In this case, a shutter speed of 1/160th of a second would be your slowest shutter speed. Of course, image stabilizer or vibration reduction will give you longer handheld speeds of 2 to 3 stops and more for some newer lenses, so you can bear this in mind when the feature is turned on. And don't be fooled, though, into thinking that image stabilizer is a magic bullet. Subject movement itself can still get you if you're shooting something that moves. Tip number 2 is from episode number 2, when I discussed a few tips to get a firm posture when you have to break the rule that I just mentioned in tip number 1. And we referenced image number 584. Firstly, the basics of holding a camera are a given, but I'm going to expand on what I said in the original podcast here, just for the sake of those that you haven't really thought about this very much yourself. So firstly, you know, supporting the camera with both hands, especially if it's an SLR, with one hand around the battery grip and with your finger on the shutter button, and the other under or around the lens. I prefer to support the lens with my hand cupped underneath it, palm up with my thumb pointing forwards, so that I can not only support the lens, but also fine-tune focusing as necessary. Also, standing with your legs apart makes you more stable. There are various schools of thought with regards to how to position your legs. Depending on the subject and, more importantly, the equipment, I'll sometimes stand with my legs parallel to the film plane, either at the side of, you know, out to each side at shoulder distance, which would make them 90 degrees off from the lens axis. This works well for shorter lenses that don't need much supporting. Other times, like when I'm using a longer or heavier lens, I'll stand kind of sideways onto the subject with my left leg out in front of me and the foot pointing towards the subject, and my right leg slightly out behind me and my right foot pointing maybe 90 degrees or so to my right. My torso is actually probably in this case going to be around 45 to 60 degrees from the film plane to the lens axis, which you can think of as the imaginary line drawn through the center of the lens, through the cylinder of the lens itself, out towards the subject. Having a good firm stance or posture to start with will definitely help. But sometimes even having raised the ISO to an acceptable limit, using wider aperture, using image stabilizer and all other technology at your disposal. And also when using a tripod or monopod is not an option, there are still going to be times when you just can't get a fast enough shutter speed to avoid camera shake. The first thing to do is to find something rigid to support you. A tree, lamppost or wall to lean against can help a lot. Get into your normal stance and then lean your weight against the wall or tree, and you'll find that you can handhold at much slower speeds. If there are no walls or trees around, then you don't need to be standing upright, or better still, as with the example I used in this episode, if you want to be low down anyway, I tend to kneel down with my right knee on the floor and my left leg bent out at a right angle in front of me, a bit like I was about to propose to someone. This way you can rest the elbow of your left hand on your knee, on your left knee that is, and then support your camera or lens with your left hand. That was actually the main tip from this episode too. I'm getting a bit carried away here, going on into so much detail about the basics of holding your camera, etc. But the other thing that I mentioned was also, I touched on this a couple of episodes ago too, but shooting in bursts when you're concerned about camera shake will also help you to get a few good shots on many occasions, as long as the shutter speed is not really just too slow. I also didn't mention this in episode two, but I literally find now that, you know, just sitting down cross-legged with my elbows resting on my knees, or even laying down like a sniper, can also make for a very firm shooting posture. I often carry a large plastic bag around with me when shooting now to keep myself relatively clean and or dry when having to do this. In episode 3, I discussed seeing shots, and I also touched on this in the latest episode, last episode too. But basically, this tip was to look around you when shooting. Being alert and looking for every photographic opportunity is very important and not something that comes naturally to everybody. But in addition to that, turning around from time to time to see what's happening behind you can really increase your chances of getting a great shot that others might miss. In episode 4, we discussed panning, looking at image number 198 and among others. Panning is when you track a moving object with your camera, most often horizontally, and shoot at a slow enough shutter speed to cause the background to blur. The main effect on shots made with this technique is that they give the impression of speed and or movement. The tricky part is to keep the subject or a part of it in crisp, sharp focus against the blurred moving background. In the image of the swan in flight, we can see that the head itself is pretty much sharply focused. The shutter speed needed to blur the background in a panning shot will vary depending on the focal length you're shooting at, but with a standard zoom lens, a shutter speed between 1/10th and 1/15th of a second should do the trick nicely. And it helps if you have image stabilizer with a mode specifically for panning. In the swan shot, I used my old 28-135mm IS lens for the for that. But this did not have mode 2 on the for Canon lenses, which is the panning mode. And so I basically was just relatively lucky that it kept the swan in focus and not latched onto the background and gave me the wrong effect. With longer lenses, so you can get a blurred background with much faster shutter speeds, but I've got to admit that I've really not tried panning with extremely long telephoto lenses, and although I am looking forward to trying this again probably next February or at least during next winter, So I'm going to be experimenting. I'll report back when I what I find, but I would advise that if you want to try panning with longer lenses than 135 or so millimeters, then you do some experimentation yourself, and make sure that you're not producing, well, for want of a better word, total crap, because it's very easy to do if you don't get the whole or the a part of the subject itself pretty sharp. So basically, the thing with this technique is, just take lots of shots. Practice really does make perfect. The more you do it, the better your results will be. In episode 5, I did a review of the Canon EOS 5D, which I'd received just a few days before that podcast. There were not really any tips in this episode, though I touched on areas like using the RGB histogram and the spot metering, etc., that was now available to me. I also recall panning the landscape picture style because it oversaturated bright colours, especially the reds. But now you'll probably know that I pretty much have my camera set to the landscape picture style all of the time now. I just deal with the overexposed individual colours as necessary now, and I prefer the nice saturated colours that remind me of the Fuji Velvia positive film that I used in my film days. In episode 6, I touched on using bokeh effectively in your images, and the first example image I used was number 559. Bokeh, as you know, is one of those words like tsunami that have made their way into the English language from Japanese, and it's used to describe the blurred areas of an image that are outside of the depth of field. If you have followed my work over the last year or so, you'll probably see that I use wide apertures quite a lot to give an image a soft, dreamy look, especially flowers, where I often leave only a tiny part of the flower in focus, like the stamen or something of interest. As I upgrade my lens arsenal to include more lenses with wide apertures, I'm finding more and more that it's possible to do this, which can be frustrating if you don't like this style of shot, but I definitely do enjoy that kind of image, and I plan to continue to employ this technique. More so with this episode, though, I talked about purposefully including items like the leaves in the foreground to add patches of translucent color to the image to increase the feeling of depth and the overall aesthetic. In episode 7, I discussed the controversial aspect of not giving away your artwork. I am still very much against people giving up their images for free, and I still believe that this is damaging the market for images. But the more I get into selling my own images, both in the form of prints from my website and commercially, the more I have come to terms with the reality of the current market. It's kind of a catch-22 thing, because the current market is where it is because people give away their images. But I continue, I guess, to think that I will not sell myself short, and I'll continue to negotiate my price for commercial work. But the cost brackets are definitely coming down. Having listened to the opinions of others, including Brooks Jensen in his Lenswork podcast and the Lenswork Extended on CD, talking about the false elitism and issues around the pricing of photography, I have in fact more than halved the cost of prints available from my website. I can't go as low as Brooks does, and I still don't know how he does it. But I have changed my opinion on this enough to modify my own pricing substantially. My basic message still stands that if I am approached by someone that wants to use my work that will in any way bring them financial gain, I will work with them to negotiate a fair price. If that negotiation does not result in my getting that price, then I walk away with the price intact. The problem now is, though, that it's deciding what that base price should be. The truth is that I've sold three times more prints since lowering the prices. Brooks is right, as usual, and staying in tune with the times and not pricing yourself out of this changing market is also very necessary for your survival. I don't know if Brooks listens to this podcast at all, but Brooks, if you do, thanks very much for your constant words of wisdom. I enjoy your podcasts and now the extended CD as much now as when it first enthused me enough to start podcasting myself a year ago. If any of you don't yet tune into the Lensworks podcast, I suggest you check it out in iTunes or take a look at both the podcast and the Lenswork extended CD at lenswork.com. In episode 8, we looked at getting in close with your landscapes. This really, though, pretty much goes for all, or most, I would say, types of photography. How many shots do you see where family snaps even or made where the gang is all lined up for the "Hey, here we are at Disneyland" group photo type thing, and there's about 40% of nothing above everyone's heads? This would be fine if the background was also interesting, and you maybe got the big castle behind you or something. But more often than not, it's just sky. You see snaps like this all the time. And if you want to photograph the sky and do the landscape shot, that's great. But if you want to photograph your family anywhere, Disneyland, wherever, take a few steps forward and fill the frame with them. The shot will have a lot more impact that way. In the context that I mentioned in episode 8 and have mentioned a few times since, taking a telephoto with you when shooting landscapes will improve your landscape work no end. Shoot the vista. The sweeping landscape is always going to be beautiful to look at when done right. But also, what the human eye does subconsciously is to isolate parts of the scene that you find interesting. So close in on them with your camera as well, as I did in image number 1095 that we looked at briefly last week. Basically, it's a sort of thing that you should really try to put it build into your work, even in landscape photography, where most people think that the wide-angle lens is the thing to go with. As you can see in image number 1095, of the steps that we can see in the waterfall, this was episode 49. You can see that it is interesting to get in and just pick out parts of a scene, as well as actually getting there and doing the whole thing. In episode 9, I discussed for the first time my weakest photographic area, which is environmental portraiture. I try to shoot portraits sometimes, especially when I'm in locations away from what I consider the norm. Many people have told me that they envy the fact that I live in Japan, and I know that I'm throwing away a lot of chances pretty much by concentrating on nature photography while I'm here. But having spent almost 13 of the last 16 years here, the Japanese people don't seem very different to me than myself, although I'm from the other side of the world. So for me, the environment that sparks the most portraiture is India. And the images that we looked at in episode 9 were all from there. One of my favorites from the trip was image number 717, and the advice linked to this image was in the interaction with the young man on the bus in the moments before I shot this image from a car on a rainy afternoon. I saw him sitting on the bus and opened the car window to get a better look. We made eye contact and I smiled and showed him my camera and gestured that I wanted to make a photo, holding the camera up to my to the side of my head and nodding towards it. He showed no objection, and as I raised the camera to my eye, he gave me that wonderful smile. I got two shots. This was the first one, and the other one slightly after this was a little blurred, and he was moving away. The bus started to pull away. But he was smiling more, but the first shot was the only real frame that I managed to get. And I also got two more after that as the bus started to really pull away, but they were totally useless. The point here is twofold. Firstly, although the fear of rejection is always in the forefront of my mind when shooting portraits, I always now get either verbal or, in cases like this where it's not possible, visual permission to shoot the subject. Second is, I think that the initial eye contact to display my intentions to the young man helped to create a connection that I think resulted in possibly the best photo of the trip. There was probably not more than 10 seconds interaction between us looking through the window since seeing the shot, getting permission and then shooting it before the bus pulled away, but I think it made all the difference. In episode 10, I went into shooting in manual mode. As with most things, I've touched on this again a number of times since, including during a recent podcast from Oidase and in my podcasts from February, the February trip to Hokkaido. Basically, as in image number 841 from my trip this year, when you are shooting a subject that might move between areas of extreme contrast, it's better to switch to manual mode. If you usually use aperture or shutter priority, or even if you use the program mode, what you need to do is to get a meter reading for the subject that you want to be correctly exposed. In this case, the white of the Japanese Red Crown crane needs to be white, and the black needs to contain detail and not have any detail loss in the shadows. Also, if I was to shoot scenes like this in aperture priority mode, the camera would give me a much slower shutter speed for the aperture when the bird flew from the white snow background to the dark background of the trees, and the whites would blow out totally, losing all detail. The best thing to do is to get a meter reading that you can trust and use that in manual mode, keeping your eye on the amount of available light if you're working outside. In this case, I took a reading from the white snow because I know that white snow on a relatively bright day will require plus 1 1/3 to 1 1/2 stops of exposure compensation to stop the white from going grey as the camera tries to render the scene like an 18% grey card. You can either get this reading in aperture or shutter priority modes and then switch to manual, or go straight to manual if your camera shows the amount that it thinks the scene is over or underexposed in the finder, and then adjust the aperture and the shutter speeds as necessary until the needle points to 1 1/3 or 1 1/2 stops over zero. If you are using a digital SLR, you can check the histogram to see if there are any flashing areas that show you that the white is close to or is actually blowing out, and then you can fine-tune the exposure as necessary. As I shot the cranes in manual mode after this, it didn't matter what the background was, you know, whether they stood against the white or flew against the dark background, because I know that their reflectivity is about the same as the snow, and so they would not get blown out as they flew against that dark background. If you're shooting anything where the background contrast can cause problems, like you know the green in the leaves we looked at recently, and then falling off into dark shadow, getting your meter reading done in advance using the histogram if you have one, and then dialing the settings in manual mode will save a lot of pain later trying to rescue detail from highlights or shadows due to bad exposure in the field. Remember that getting it right in the field is the key to good quality images at the other end of your workflow. I also went into detail about calculating exposure values in episode 10 to help when shooting in manual mode, including how to quickly calculate how much to raise or change the aperture if you need a different shutter speed or the ISO, for example. This subject takes a fair amount of explaining though, so if you're not comfortable with calculating shutter speed and aperture ISO shifts on the fly, then go back to episode 10 and take a listen for a full explanation. Okay, so that's it for this week. I'll try to be a little more concise next week, and I'll continue to skip the lesser tips. I'll try to keep this down to two or a max of three episodes. Remember though, if you heard anything that sounds useful today or interesting, the old episodes are still there in the archive, so you can go back and listen to any of them again at your leisure. One more piece of housekeeping for today is a reminder that the Depicting Cultures assignment is now closed, and voting has started until September the 3rd. Congratulations once again to Graham for your winning the competition, and come to think of it, congratulations to Orchid too for selling your first photo. It was a great photo from when you first showed it us on the members gallery, and you know, I'm really, really pleased for you that things are really starting to come together with your photography. So congratulations to Orchid as well. So thank you very much for listening. Have a great week, whatever you do, and I'll speak to you again next week. Bye-bye.